So what we've seen here in the last week is really an explosion in the amount of cosmological data that we're getting. We've seen high-resolution maps of the cosmic microwave background. We've seen what people call routine measurements of SC clusters. There's been a possible detection of the far-infrared background and sources from SCUBA that might make it up. And I think it's fair to say that one of the strong drivers for this revolution in data is the detectors, and both coherent receivers for longer wavelengths and volumetric detectors for shorter wavelengths. And in fact, I recently learned about this figure of merit that people call astronomical capability, and it's the number of pixels that you can measure at a time divided by the square root of the sensitivity, and it basically tells you how long you have to observe to get to a certain flux or a temperature per pixel. And Paul Richards calculated how fast this astronomical capability has been going up in the time that he's been working on bolometers, and he found that the doubling time is about 11 months. So it's actually faster than Moore's law, which tells you you're in trouble in terms of data analysis. But so the subject of my talk today... The subject of my talk today is some attempts to stay on that fast track and to be making detector arrays much more sensitive in the future and bring yet richer yields of cosmology. So this is the team at Berkeley and more recently collaborating some with TRW. Now before I talk about the different detectors we're working on, be a brief review. This is how a generic bolometer works, and here's our acronym. We call these things voltage bias superconducting bolometers, or VSBs, so keep that acronym in mind for the rest of the talk. And this is how a generic bolometer works. So you have an absorber of radiation, has a heat capacity, and it's at a certain temperature T. Optical power is coming from the telescope, and because there's only a weak link to a low temperature bath here, this optical power heats this absorber above the temperature of the bath, and you put a thermometer on it, and you read out the temperature, and that tells you how much power you're getting from your telescope. And typically, a thermometer has to have some bias power, so the total power being dissipated in this bolometer is the sum of the optical power and the bias power. Now, so how does this VSB work? Well, you all know that the superconducting transition, resistive superconducting transition, is very sharp, and what we do is we put enough bias power into this to heat it up enough to put it in the transition. And what happens there? Well, the bias power is V squared over R. So you can see that if I add optical power, it's going to go up the transition. R will increase. That'll decrease the power. So you can see that what's happening is the bias power is fighting the optical power. So this effect is called electrothermal feedback. And in this case, it's negative. And it makes this detector a null detector. It's trying to hold this power constant as best it can. So it's analogous, in a sense, to an op-amp, which is trying to hold its inputs at zero. So Kent Irwin at Stanford realized that this negative electrothermal feedback would be valuable for detectors in general. And this team here wrote the first paper describing this effect for bolometric detectors. One more background slide about this. This is how we instrument these detectors. VSB is just a variable resistor here. And the current from the VSB is read out by this device, which has a coil. And then the magnetic field from that is read with a superconducting quantum interference device. And this superconducting quantum interference device is a very important part of this detector system. One of the ways that we want to increase the astronomical capability is to make really large arrays of detectors. And one of the actual very important impediments to doing that is how you read out such big arrays. And SQUIDs have very good properties for measuring out low-temperature bolometers. They have very low power dissipation. They dissipate a nanowatt per device rather than a milliwatt. So if you think about thousands or tens of thousands of bolometers, this is going to be a very nice property. Another thing that's very good is that the combination of the SQUID and the VSB, you have a lot of noise margin. So the VSB noise is more than an order of magnitude higher than the SQUID noise, and that's going to be very important for reading out a lot of detectors, as I'll describe soon. So this is a summary of the rest of my talk, or a list of things I'm going to talk about, and don't worry, I'm only going to show about a view graph per subject here. So I already talked about this in 1996. we demonstrated the first hot electron VSB. And why is this called a hot electron VSB? There's two kinds of ways you can make a bolometer. One is to make suspensions where you isolate them mechanically. The other thing is if you use a very small piece of metal, what happens is actually the electrons decouple in temperature from the local lattice, and so they have their own equilibrium temperature. And you can get very sensitive detectors by using this effect. And although this NEP of 10 to the minus 17 or so that we demonstrated is rather pedestrian these days, that by making the devices smaller, you can make them a lot more sensitive. In fact, if you push this to the limits of modern photography, you get about 10 to the minus 20 watts per root hertz. And although you don't need that good sensitivity for CMB, if you think about cold telescopes in space, looking at early forming galaxies with narrow bandwidths, that's the kind of sensitivity you need, and this is one nice way to do that. In 1998, we demonstrated the first suspended VSB, and in 1999, we made the first spiderweb absorber VSB, so following on the geometry that's been made by Bach and Lang. So what is new, and what we're working on right now, is listed down here. We're working on antenna-coupled VSBs, and so rather than using a horn, using a planar antenna, and one of the great promises of this is having multichoroic pixels using planar filters. So a little bit like the frequency selective bolometer concept, but here we're using planar filters that are quite well understood. Next thing I'll talk about is fully filled absorber-coupled arrays, and these are really complementary to the antenna-coupled ones. You can get very efficient there. They're more like a CCD camera. You put them in the focal plane of your telescope, and you can get nearly very efficient photon collection over your field of view, and you can also get Nyquist sampling so that you don't have to do jitters with your telescope. The next thing I'll talk about is a single squid readout multiplexer. So this is one of the really important development areas, being able to read out multiple detectors with a single readout channel. If you think about making an array of 1,000 or 10,000 bolometers, you don't want to run 1,000 or 10,000 sets of wires out of your cryostat. For the experimentalists in the room, that's a scary thing to think about. And so what you really want to do is have some kind of multiplexer. And people have been working hard on this. The NIST group have a very nice design. And we have a new design that uses only a single squid rather than they use multiple squids to read out many channels. And finally, we had some excess noise in early devices, and we've been working hard on a model for that and have a suggested remedy. So I talked about the first suspended bolometer that we made, and so this is that paper there. And that device was nice because it had a heater where we could dial the power being dissipated in the heater to mimic optical power. And so here's the total power in the device as a function of this heater power that we can dial up and down. And as I said before, it's a null detector. It tries to hold this power as constant as it can. And you can see it's doing a pretty good job there. I can recast this data as a current through the bolometer as a function of heater power. And what you can see is that it's very linear. The responsivity of this device, which is a current per optical power, should just be minus 1 over VB. So if you were to write that equation for a standard bolometer, it's a long equation with a lot of parameters in it. But just like an op amp, strong feedback means that your performance just depends on the feedback parameters. In this case, it's the voltage, resistors in the case of an op amp. And so everything drops out. And you can see it has a very nice linear behavior, and it does correspond to theory. And this could be very important for observations. For one, as the temperature bath of your fridge varies, your calibration won't vary. Also, as your loading from the sky varies, your responsivity won't vary. So if you think, for example, of doing differential polarization measurements, that could be an important feature. Here's the spiderweb absorber VSB that we made. And you can see a scale here. So this geometry was first developed by Bach and Lang, who are now at Caltech. And so what we did that was new is we put a superconducting sensor at the center here of the web. And so this device could be made entirely by optical photolithography, no glue or anything required. So and this device operated at 300 millikelvin. Now, here's a picture from my earlier talk of the Maxima instrument. And And the way it's made is there's horns here to couple the telescope, filters for the bolometers, and finally bolometers there. And the reason I'm showing it again is because this isn't the way you want to make an array of 1,000 or 10,000 bolometers. There's a lot of handwork that goes into this, as some people in the room know. A perhaps better way of making a lot of bolometers is to exploit the fact that full lithography can make a lot of things, replicate a lot of things easily. And here's one way of doing that. So in this case, we were doing everything on a planar substrate. There's a ground plane under all of this made of supergraphene niobium. And we're going to use in this example a double flat dipole that has been used, for example, by Zimisamis for his SIS mixers. And so this has a very nice antenna pattern, very even E and H plane, similar E and H plane beam patterns. And we bring the radiation that's coupled by this antenna with the superconducting transmission lines here to this device here, which is an RF multiplexer. So what happens here is that we break out the bandwidth detected by the antenna into different frequency bands. So there's one line here per frequency band. So this pixel is multichroic. You can have several frequency bands. And so, for example, for the CMB, you can imagine having, say, four or five wide bandwidths. At the end here, there are bolometers. I put hot electron bolometers in this case, which directly couple to these lines. And finally, in this particular picture, I have a NIST-style squid multiplexer where squids are used as switches to turn on and off the readout of a particular bolometer and send the signal to this squid here, which is the only squid you need for this many detectors. So these filters here, and I should mention that the way these work is you can think of these quarter-wave stubs here as LC resonators, and you can make up high pass, low pass, or band pass as you will. And there's a lot of flexibility here, and they're very well understood by the engineering community. And you can have either broadband photometry, or you can get up to RF100 spectroscopy also. So that could be very interesting, for example, for looking at early forming galaxies. And that RF100 is limited by how much loss there is in the superconducting transmission lines. So as I said, one nice thing about photolithography is if you can make one, you can make a lot of these things. And so what you see here is a 4-inch wafer with 100 pixels in the center in the field of view here. And what's being done here is to use the very low loss of superconducting transmission lines to bring the signals outside the field of view and do all your filtering, RF filtering, and signal multiplexing out here on the periphery. So we have 100 pixels on the sky simultaneously, about 1,000 bolometers, and everything's integrated, antennas, filters, bolometers, and readout. And so you can imagine all the different science goals you could do with this. What I write, for example, CMB polarization would be a very good, this would be a very good device for CMB polarization. And what I forgot to mention was that Zimisamis has a very nice dual polarization antenna that could be used for doing differential polarimetry. So if you imagine such antennas at the field of view here, this could be a very good way of doing differential polarimetry by making a very large array of such devices. And of course, we need very high sensitivity. So as an example, sensitivity, if you were able to make a 200 by 200 array of such devices, this would be 100 times the instantaneous sensitivity of Planck. And so if you add in the also the scan strategy of going to smaller bits of sky, that would be, you get quite far this parameter space of trying to search for the gravity wave component. Also, such an array would be very nice for doing SC with the appropriate bands. As I mentioned, looking for early forming galaxies if you exploit the fact that you can get moderate resolution spectroscopy. And where are we in actually making such things? We're working on a single pixel system. And here's a design for a single band pass. And the input's there, the output's there. There's a ground plane under the whole thing. And here's the calculated bandpass of such a thing. And people who work in the SC will recognize how I chose the center band there, about 217 gigahertz. We're making 300 millikelvin aluminum titanium proximity effect sandwiches, detectors that are hot electron decoupled, VSBs. And here you can see most of what you see here are connection pads, and the detectors are the little things here that have scale of several microns on a side. And finally, we're making a single pixel receiver. We had a student visit from Chalmers, and we he did a quasi-optical design for a single pixel channel for antenna coupling. So the antenna, there's a little silicon hemispherical lens here, and the antenna is smack up against that. Oh, right, there's no antennas on this particular one. Yeah, it's F of several.
This is just a single pixel test viewer, it's not a astronomical.
Yeah. Okay. So the what you do, the bolometers, even though they're superconducting, if the photons are above twice the gap, they'll break Cooper pairs. And so the normal resistance is the resistance you're trying to couple to, and that could be an ohm or 10 ohms. And the double flat dipoles have an impedance of about 33 ohms. So what you want to do is you want to have an impedance transformer, and there are a lot of, for example, you can imagine a quarter wave step. And because the losses are so low, you can do that, you can do that quite well. Anything below their superconducting temperature, which is about 9 Kelvin, so 4 Kelvin, for example. Okay, so... Right, so the, it keeps open the possibility of having the squids right on the substrate, which would be nice. Okay, so now this is a new topic, and I'm going to talk about the absorber-filled arrays. And... people have been working on filled arrays of bolometers. There's a pop-up design that Harvey Mosley has from Goddard. And the CEA group in France has been making a design also. What's different about our design is that it's completely monolithic. It's only on one substrate, and that means that they're simpler to make and high yield. And the secret, of course, is to make to make a very small area suspension electrical leads. And I'll talk about that in a second, but what we could do at the end is have about 88% filling factor of the focal plane for a 32 by 32 array. So here's a picture of one detector here that we've made. This is a silicon nitride micromesh, a little bit like a silicon, like a spiderweb bolometer. But what's different about it is that instead of having a large area suspension, the suspension is a silicon nitride member that runs from top to bottom that's connected at two points on the side here. So it's a very compact suspension, which means you can butt these things up very close to each other and fill the focal plane very efficiently. And here I just show how you need a back reflector for such a bolometer, and this is just the particular geometric implementation we make. Made one of these devices and tested it, and here's noise from that device. Here are the particular parameters from that device. NEP is about 10 to the minus 17, running at 300 millikelvin. Winterfrequency is fairly good for observations that are chopped. And here we see a little bit of excess noise, and we believe we understand that, and I'll talk about that at the very end. If you extrapolate the performance of this device to 100 millikelvin, you can get G's about down to 10 to the minus 13, and NEP is close to 10 to the minus 18, just under 10 to the minus 18. Well, as you know, the fundamental noise that you get is 4 kT squared G, right? And typically, NTD detectors get about square root of 2 to factor 2 higher, so there's a modest increase in sensitivity. Now, just as with the antenna coupled bolometers, photolithography allows us to make a lot of these things. And this is a 32 by 32 array of micromeshes. So these aren't detectors. We haven't put the sensors on yet. But the hard part's really making the micromeshes. Maybe I shouldn't say that too quickly. But it's fair to say it is hard to make the micromeshes. So this is a 32 by 32 array of micromeshes and 4.8 centimeters on a side. And these are all fully released. They're all intact. so the yield is quite high. And as you can imagine, this would be a very powerful array for a lot of different observations. And when I asked Jan Gildemeister, who made this array, why he didn't try 100 by 100, he looked at me with a straight face and he said, it wouldn't fit on the wafer. So now that might be bravado, but I think it does indicate that the particular way we're making them has good potential for making a lot of these things. So this is the next topic, reading out a lot of detectors with one squid. And so, as I said, the NIST group has a very nice design, but they use one squid per bolometer. And what's different about ours is that we're only using a single squid per row and per row of detectors, so thinking in terms of a square array. And so the way we do it is, with this schematic here, we AC bias each of the detectors, but at a different frequency for each one. And then we take all those signals and we sum them in this thing we call a summing loop. So basically, by transformer coupling, we can add all the currents. And we null the current in this loop by having a feedback transformer. So after we detect the current, we null the current in this loop. And that kills the crosstalk that you would have without doing that nulling. So then we bring out the signal from the squid to room temperature. And at room temperature, we can demodulate each of these different bolometer signals by lock-in detection. So here, we've actually built one of these, although we've only tested it with resistors. And so here's here are the bias frequencies. So there are 8 of them, and several of these are also being amplitude modulated with a multiplier circuit to give you a mock signal. And then when we demodulate, we can see that locking into one frequency, we see the signal that we expect that's amplitude modulated, and no crosstalk in the next channel. And so, as I said, we've built an 8-channel prototype with niobium transformers. And there's 2 limits to the number of detectors that we can multiplex. One is the squid bandwidth, but that's not very constraining. You could get, with a time constant of 10 microseconds, you could get 100 bolometers into a 3 megahertz squid bandwidth. So if you had a 1 millisecond bolometer, you can get about 10,000. The more constraining thing is that even though the detector noise is narrow band, the Johnson noise is actually is wide band. And so the Johnson noise from this detector would go underneath all the other detectors. So what we need to do is we need to implement some kind of bandwidth limiting filter, for example, a passive LC filter, to narrow band around each of these carriers. And that's what we're looking into right now. Just to show you what this looks like, this is the device that Jungsu Yoon at Berkeley made. And each of these is a transformer. The way it works is there's a coil, and there's another coil next to it, and that forms a transformer. And so there's 8 of them. There's one extra for the feedback, and then we hook the squid up to here. And this is all superconducting niobium. You can get the scale there. And here's the inside, just to show the detail and how we have to bring the leads out from the center. Okay, final topic is noise. In our very early devices, the spiderweb devices, we saw excess noise, and there was 2 possible models, and they both had to do with thermal fluctuations. And one of the models was that we were having thermal fluctuations within the sensor itself, and the other was that we had thermal fluctuations within the extended thermal circuit and with electrothermal feedback that gave you the noise. So what we had to do to discriminate between these two noise models is we made an array, and this was done by Jan Gildemeister. We made an array of VSBs with varied parameters. So you can see they all look different. They all have different heat capacities hanging off of them. And as a side note, this is a 2x16 array, so it's not that small an array. And Jan was able to make it fairly quickly. And then we measured noise from several of these devices, and you can see the noise performance here. And you can see that the noise is very different, but yet the model seems to fit the data fairly well. So that allowed us to conclude that model 2 is dominant, meaning the extended thermal circuit and electrothermal feedback. And that and now knowing which model is dominant, we should be able to approach ideal noise by just reducing the heat capacities of these devices. So that was an important step in our understanding. So final view graph, and that's the low-frequency noise. Of course, having very good low-frequency noise is important for some observations. For example, for Planck, it's very important. And at first, we didn't push very hard on understanding how low the 1RF of our devices were. And now this has moved along a little bit more. And here you see the noise of one of the devices I showed in the last view graph. And this line here is not a fit to the data, but this is the fundamental thermal fluctuation limit. This is the lowest noise you can have for a given G from thermal fluctuations. And what you can see is that all the way down to about 200 millihertz, we're right on the line. And again, we have this peak at high frequencies, but you can see this particular device is already fairly good for observation. It noises pretty flat out to about 20 hertz. And this has an NEP of about 10 to the minus 17, and time cost about 2 milliseconds. And so a final note here, our old papers and three new papers will be put on this website sometime this summer. Thanks. Okay, so right now we've done everything at about 300 millikelvin. And basically the way we set the TC is so that it's about 1.5 times over the base temperature of the fridge. So it turns out there's an optimal temperature rise. And we can also we've been making them at 300 kelvin just to make the research quicker because it's easier to work at 300 millikelvin. But we could also make them at 100 millikelvin by making differently tuned proximity effect sandwiches. I didn't really get to talk about that, but basically by varying the thicknesses of the metals and the different metals, you can dial in the TC, and we could make them also for 100 millikelvin operation. Okay, so I think. Okay, but let's put it in perspective. So basically, it's very basically the number. Let's assume that detectors are good enough to be photon noise limited. Then basically, the more detectors you have, the less time you need to reach a certain delta T, right? So the fact that this has the array I showed, the antenna-coupled one, with, let's say, a 200 by 200 array, it has it can integrate down about, it has 100 times instantaneous sensitivity, or 10,000 times faster than Planck. So you could do Planck in 10,000 times less time if you had that on a satellite. I guess that's, if you wanted one number, it's that Planck could be done. Excuse me? No, it's the limitation is the following. The best you can do is if you're detecting every photon coming through into your diffraction-limited field of view, if you're detecting all of them and your photon noise limited, that's about as good as you can do. Planck is not detecting all of the photons coming through. It doesn't have a big enough array. So there is a big factor there. But it does, as you point out, it does depend on how well you can do, will depend on the details of how big a field of view you could build, in addition to how big a detector array you could build.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point because you can't put 10,000 detectors
in the way out of
my detector array. It's not possible.
So I
thought
that
this would be an interesting point. If the focal plane array is too soft, you just can't stick that many detectors in the focal plane.
Right, but it is. Yeah, but it's not far off because, for example, the SCUBA telescope at 700 microns, they are designing 200 by 200 arrays that's filling the. Yeah, so it's not. I'm claiming it's not far off.
Okay.
Well, your sensitivity to anisotropy is falling off pretty quickly, so my guess is probably not, but you could work the numbers out.
One of the issues with the antenna-coupled kilometers, we looked at, I'm sure you looked at, is the primary gain coming off is antenna-coupling is really rather poor because the kind of gain that we're using during the 48 line. background, focus on your raise, you know, for higher background or for a raise where you don't care so much about the sidewalk rejection, probably the case.
Mm-hmm.
But no one might be okay, but if a millimeter band, definitely has a question as to how well you can help with the light in and not a lot of block.
Right, but that's an important issue. That's an important issue, and for example, using a Leo stop could be the right thing to do for a raise with that kind of double slot dipole. So just to clarify, the main beams from those kind of slot dipoles are actually very nice, and as I said, very even between the E and H planes. But as you point out, corrugated horns are spectacular in their side lobes, and you can't do that well. But by use of a Leo stop, you could might be able to do quite well. Yeah. And we should thank all the organizers. So that's Bill and Sarah, who I think skipped out, and Mark, right? And Martin.